As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I thank you for joining us. Now, if you're a regular listener, you might be wondering what happened to my voice. Well, it happens occasionally. You lose your voice, owing to the fact that I stayed up very, very late last night to watch the Philadelphia Eagles upset the Evil Empire in a really phenomenal game, I thought. But of course, it always seems better when you go out and win. Nick Foles is your Super Bowl MVP. So there. And I even felt a tiny, tiny bit sorry for Tom Brady. No, not at all, actually. Felt a little bit sorry for Bill Belichick. But then, you know what? You made your mistakes. And it's tougher to win when you're not cheating anyway. Right, with me in the studio today, it's a real treat because with me is former Crystal Palace and Leicester City striker James Scowcroft. And down the line, speaking to us from his leafy gaff in lovely Ripponden, drop by whenever you like, it's somewhere in the north of England, it's the chief football correspondent at the Times, Ollie Kaye. Later on in our debate, we'll be talking about the dismissal of West Ham's head of recruitment, Tony Henry, after comments he made about African players. We'll be touching upon the atmosphere at Old Trafford. And again, I have to remind people of this because it is extremely significant. James Scowcroft here is perhaps the only former professional footballer of any note that I know who actually pays for his own tickets.
Mark Albrighton, unless there's a big Aston Villa fan.
Does any play at the same time?
Not all the time. He goes to watch Villa a lot, though.
And does he pay for his own tickets?
Yes, he does, apparently.
Oh, that said, there's one place to start, and that's at Anfield. It's Klopp versus Pochettino. It's Liverpool versus Spurs. It's the kind of place that sent Martin Tyler into ecstasy yesterday. Well, I'm going to begin with you because I watched this game. I thought it was pretty much breathless. It was exciting. And you know, this is the way Klopp plays. Pochettino could have played. Maybe he's a little bit more pragmatic at times, but he chose to go at it. At the end, everybody went nuts. Are you going to join in this fantastic advert for the Premier League type argument? Or are you going to say it's a fantastic advert for a certain type of tactical vision in the Premier League, but it was also a game filled with all sorts of mistakes?
It was definitely full of mistakes. It was a lot of mistakes being forced by a good attacking play, but yeah, there was an awful lot of mistakes from Spurs in the first 20 minutes and obviously Liverpool in the second half were sort of clinging onto a lead, which is something they just don't seem equipped to do, really. I mean, I think Liverpool holding a one-goal lead is not something that they're bound to excel at, and they drop deeper, and you could criticise that. You could criticise the way Spurs started the game, which was full of errors and with a sort of questionable shape in midfield and questionable sort of put pegs in right holes in midfield. But for all that, I mean, I think most of the games that we sort of celebrate in the Premier League are these sort of breathless 100 miles an hour games, which tend to be full of mistakes, and this was one of them. And it was one where, you know, sitting in the press box at Anfield, the game ended and you were thinking, God, you know, where to start with that, because there was just, you know, so much went on, and you know, not just the controversy, not just the sort of strangeness about the way decisions were reached, but the incident, the drama, the quality as well. It was a fantastic game.
Ollie, you were at the game. And there's a slight point I would like to pick up, really. So I watched Liverpool and I watched Klopp, and Klopp is very, very passionate on the sideline, and that's great. When Salah scores to go 2-1 up, he goes charging down the line towards the cop, 30, 40 yards, maybe a little bit further, celebrating. And that's fine. I get all of that. He's celebrating with the crowd. For me, Liverpool have got a problem with their game management. So they've gone 2-1 up. They've got 4 minutes to go. And instead of losing his emotion and getting carried away with everything, is that not a time for him to manage the game, manage his players from the sideline and get everybody to focus? Because those last minutes, those last few minutes is all about the team. Tottenham going to come at you. They're going to have the ball. They're going to try and make an error. They're going to put the ball in the box. Is that not where you get your team to focus for 4 minutes? Forget the celebrations. Yeah, you can do it for a few seconds, but get your team organised and get them switched on. Because I look at Liverpool and I look at Van Dijk, where he's just not concentrating. He's not aware of what's lamellas around him. He's not aware of certain situations. And I see that with a few Liverpool players. And the managers that I've played for, you're always very vulnerable when you've scored a goal. And good managers that I've played for, the first thing they would do is send a message out to the team: focus. You've got 4 minutes left to win this game. Concentrate, because it will come from a mistake. Do you agree, Ollie, or not?
No,
I do agree that there's, you know, it's too polite. The idea of a manager charging down the touchline after a 91st minute goal.
He's not in control.
I mean, it does suggest that you know, heads have gone and it's over exuberance and hearts are controlling hands. And I think Liverpool's approach is all about that over exuberance, and they're not very good at the other stuff, the game management. Whether that's because Klopp is hyper animated on the touchline, or whether that's just because of the way they set up or the type of players they have, I think it's really hard to say. I think it's 12 points that they've dropped from winning positions this season, and it probably feels like more than they did it a few times in the Champions League as well. And you know, they do have that sort of screw loose, don't they, Liverpool?
they can't manage a lead. That's their problem. And you can't always blame that on the individuals. There's many factors in that, but one factor is the way that they're managed and the way they're coached.
I want to talk about the penalty decisions before we move on. The first one, Ollie, was actually very complicated to some degree until you pick up the rule book. I know it seems to mystify the pundits on television. There's two separate issues here. There's the conversation, and I think we do need to get into this. We have the transcript here between the referee, Jonathan Moss, and the linesman, Ed Smart. But in terms of what the rules say on the first one, he's not offside if Lovren played the ball deliberately. And so it all comes down to whether you think Lovren played the ball deliberately. In our paper, Mark Klattenberg says that he didn't, because Lovren's a professional footballer and he would not have played it into Kane's path on purpose. Many, if not most, other former refs and so on who've weighed in on this have said really the reverse of that. And this is the conclusion, I guess, that Moss and Smart came to, that, yeah, Lovren may be a professional footballer, but he clearly mishit this or hit this in such a way that it was deliberate rather than just a deflection, and therefore Kane is not offside. Is that a fair summation of what the rules are? And the difference of opinion comes down to how you interpret Lovren?
Yeah, as with so much, it comes down to how you interpret the laws, and it, which just shows how ridiculously ambiguous the laws are. And for a FIFA referee, or, you know, a guy who's just retired or effectively retired as a FIFA referee, to have that interpretation of it, as Klattenberg did, is, I mean, it's quite bizarre, really. I mean,
But Klattenberg is 100% correct. This is what the rules are. The only subjective part is whether you think Lovren played the ball deliberately or not, right?
Well, he did deliberately play the ball. It didn't bounce off him. He tried to clear it, and obviously.
But Klattenberg says no, because and I quote here: a professional footballer would not have played it into Kane's path on purpose.
As he watched Liverpool defend, I just thought Lovren was decent yesterday, apart from that. But no, I mean, the rule says a player in offside position receiving a ball from an opponent who deliberately plays the ball, except from a deliberate save, is not considered to have gained an advantage. So it's about deliberately playing the ball. It's not about deliberately kicking it in a certain direction. If it's not clear, if Klattenberg has one interpretation and if John Moss has another, and it's mad that there is that grey area over it. I mean, the Klopp was coming into the press conference and he said, you know, unless the rules changed, that's not offside. And you think, well, no, the rules seem to, and it seemed to suggest that he was onside. There are various referees now with columns and papers, and Mark Clattenburg does ours, and I generally agree with him on these issues. But to be honest, I totally disagree with his interpretation of that, because I thought it was onside. And then I thought the one thing where Liverpool might have had a point was that I felt Harry Kane might have dived with
that. Come on, that's the England centre forward you're talking about.
Well, exactly.
Not some dodgy foreigner. Stop it. I'll have no more of this Kane diving discussion. That's really inappropriate.
But I'm not certain about that dive, but that was my feeling. It was not a popular view in the press box, and it's not one I would be certain of. But it was... It certainly looked like there was certainly a possibility of a dive, and I find it very hard for people to say it wasn't a dive.
The interesting thing about this interpretation of the decision is the conversation, which, again, I thought this was strange, because we so often see referees, and when they consult with their assistants, you know, they kind of cover their mouths or whatever. Here it seemed to me as if they seemed to invite the cameras over, so we know exactly what was said. And I'm tempted... You're a bit of a thespian, aren't you, Scoey? Shall we read this conversation? I'll play smart, you'll be Moss, okay? If you had a script there, you could join us too. Do you, Ollie?
I do. Who would you want me to be?
Why don't you be Ericsson? So I'll be smart and Sean, and you're Moss, and you'll be Ericsson. You only have one line.
And this is, it's not Punch and Judy. This is the script, isn't it? It's real.
This is exactly what it says. You ready? Here goes. All I need to know is, did Lovren touch the ball?
I don't know.
Well, if he's not touched the ball, it is offside. So you're chalking off the penalty. It has to be offside if Lovren has not touched the ball.
He touched it, ref.
He did not touch the ball. You know what I'm asking. I need to clarify. Has Lovren touched the ball? If he has, it's a deliberate action, and therefore it's a penalty. If he has not, it is offside.
I have no idea whatever. This is Moss, not me, by the way. I have no idea, whatever. Lovren touched the ball, to be honest with you, Martin. Have you got anything from TV? I'm giving the penalty.
Now, all right, first of all, what strikes me is it seems to me as if, like, Smart is Moss's boss here, and he's kind of telling him what to do. Moss is, I think, is considered a pretty decent referee, but he's kind of bossed around by his assistant.
24 hours on and we're still debating it, and we've seen it time and time again. To be fair to these two guys, they've got to make a big decision.
But this, have you got anything from TV? That's not so cool, is that, Ollie?
Well, my mind immediately goes back to the 2006 World Cup final and the feeling that Zidane was sent off due to a fourth official highlighting something that had been seen on a screen, and this was, you know, 12 years before VAR might be brought in. This wasn't a VAR trial game yesterday, and people get very upset by the idea of VAR being used in some games and not others. Now, if it's being used on the sly, then, you know, people are entitled to ask, you know, what's going on. Surely you're not meant to do that. But I don't know. Do I have a problem with it? I don't know that I have, but I'd just like people to be a bit more honest about the process. If VAR is being sort of used by stealth, they should just admit that. If the fourth official is helping with things that he's seeing on a TV that he's got half an eye on the bench, then the Premier League, PGMO, everybody needs to be honest about that and not let allow the embarrassment that will bring kind of all kinds of conspiracy theories and all that nonsense. Moss was being as bold as brass about it yesterday.
I love this guy does not have a devious bone in his body.
But people are going to ask questions of the Premier League, of PGMO, of the FA about this. People need to be upfront about it and clear about it.
I won't spend too much time on this, but obviously Harry Kane missed the penalty. Then Mohamed Salah scored a tremendous, tremendous goal. By the way, we should give some love to Wanyama, also an absolute rocket of a goal. And then came the second penalty, which I thought was a prototypical dumb penalty. Lamela may have been offside. Mark Clattenburg thought he was offside. But I think it's pretty obvious, as it didn't occur to Virgil van Dijk, that you know, he was offside. It seemed to me that what Van Dijk did was kind of stupid. Can you explain his mindset? Scully, have you done things like that?
I've done many things like that that are stupid, but I just...
You've given away penalties in the fourth minute of injury time? Because you
switched off
you were following your manager who was celebrating down the time.
Listen, you disagree with me, but I know I've got a point. It's lack of awareness, lack of concentration.
Well, this is the most expensive defender in the world you're talking about.
Well, whatever he is, it's a lack of concentration in a crucial, crucial moment of the game. He's got no idea where Lamella is. You know, his body shape's wrong, he's turned off, he's probably thinking about the game that have just won. And it's a penalty. You know, he comes on his blind side. Lamella knows what he's doing. I think it's good play by Lamella. And he just lashes out and he catches him. Doesn't catch him a lot, but it is a penalty.
Right, now this season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League, and the FA Cup as well. Now, just £3 for a three-month trial. In addition to all that goodness, you also get our excellent content, including our Under the Skin of the Game feature, which I quite enjoy, especially when George Culkin writes it. Now, he didn't write it this week. It was you, Ollie, who wrote about Duncan Edwards this week. Also very interesting. Not quite George Culkin, but still. No. Ollie, what was your favourite goal of the weekend in the Premier League?
There were four outstanding sort of long-distance goals, Danilo, Lamina, Izquierdo and Wanyama, which would be very hard to separate. So you go for a different type of goal completely, which would be Mo Salah's goal, you know, the second goal, deep in injury time, the one that sent Klopp darting down the touchline. It was ridiculous. It was one of those ones where there seemed no way through and he wriggled through, and I tweeted at the time that it was a Messi-esque goal, and you know, people go, oh my god, take that back, how could you compare him with Messi? I'm comparing the goal to the type of goal Messi scored, because it was that sort of impossible dribble, balance, the audacity to sneak it through that tiny space. I thought it was an absolutely brilliant goal.
Scully, I'm assuming your goal will be a Manchester United goal, right?
It is. I've gone for
funnily enough,
I've gone for Lukaku's goal, simply because I think it's a very, very good goal.
Ahead of Alexis Sanchez's missed penalty, and then
it was a tough decision, very, very cool. And I didn't sleep well last night thinking about it, but I plumped for Lukaku. I think he's a very good player, Lukaku. And I did a thing for a Manchester United podcast this week and said how I personally think he's had a very good season. Wonderful ball in by one matter. And all centre forwards are told, get across your man at the near post and front foot finish, which you take it with your nearest foot. I thought it was a very good goal, and one I enjoyed.
But he's not as good as Martial, is he?
No.
Arsenal 5, Everton 1. It's an absolute mauling. Now, some people, like me, and I still stand by it, but hey, when the facts change, my opinion will change, will argue that this wasn't some kind of genius transfer window from Arsenal, because there's a lot of questions raised. Aubameyang, Lacazette, Mkhitaryan, Ozil, how do the pieces fit together and blah, blah, blah. But that said, Ollie, when you're playing a team that sets up in this completely, what I thought was a pretty nonsensical sort of 7-0-3 formation, where the front three guys are all in there because they can run rather than play, it becomes a heck of a lot easier, right? And then you get Aaron Ramsey scoring a hat-trick and Mkhitaryan with three assists, and life is good.
Well, yeah, I mean, Everton were awful. It was one of the worst performances I've seen by any team in the Premier League this season. I don't think...
Performances we've ever seen. One of the most un-Allardyce performances, right?
Yeah.
It's like it wasn't him out there. It's like they put some sort of clone out there who... You know, I'm not saying Allardyce is always brilliant, and he's often not, but you can generally see what he's trying to do, whereas this was terrible.
You can, and generally the way his teams play is you know, being very aware of risks and being very aware of leaving gaps, and it was very, very naive and very, very, you know, spineless really as a performance. But it was, Arsenal were very good. I mean, Arsenal, you sometimes see a team score four times in the first half without playing really well. And I thought Arsenal's first half performance was really, really good. They were full of ideas, full of energy, full of confidence. And yes, Everton definitely made it easier for them. But when you've got Mkhitaryan in that mood, you've got Ozil in that mood, you've got Ramsey breaking from midfield, and Aubameyang making the type of runs he made and being the kind of threat he is. I thought it was a really good performance. I'm not at all of the view that, you know, a swallow makes a summer as far as Arsenal are concerned. I think they will blow very hot and cold for the rest of the season, I suspect, because it looks very individualistic what they've got. It looks like there's not really a kind of balanced team there yet. But that was a very good performance.
So you're not convinced. You remain a skeptic on this point. Are you also a skeptic on whether Wenger was the main driver of these signings in this transfer strategy?
I am sceptical of that, yeah. Aubameyang and Mkhitaryan are players he has liked before but has watched before, but then again, isn't everybody? You know, that doesn't every time a player makes an impact, another theme that we hear that Wenger knew of him and Wenger wanted to sign him. But there is a different dynamic now at Arsenal with Sven Mislintat and with a guy who's come from Barcelona as a director of football operations.
Raul.
Definitely not director of football. Definitely not director of football. He's just director of football operations, Arsene. Don't worry. But I think the dynamic there behind the scenes is changing. I think it's moving towards a post-Wenger world, and I guess that might be scary, it might be exciting, but I thought Saturday's performance was exciting.
Scully, should we pick on Everton some more? Because I'm thinking, if I'm Farhad Moshiri, who bought 49% of Everton, definitely with my own money and nobody else's money,
yep.
You just spent £21 million and more in wages to sign a centre forward in Tosun. Your club, and okay, these guys were signed before you, but Rooney and Sigurdsson end up on the bench, and these are two guys the club brought in at vast expense over the summer. Presumably they were bought in by a director of football, possibly your mate Steve Walsh, who signed these guys and then signed you, Big Sam, and presumably you spoke to him and said, like, these are our biggest assets. You know, are you on board with this? I don't understand. What's going on? We have a piece from Paul Joyce. Quite a salty, I'd say, comment piece, where he makes the point that Everton are in danger of losing their identity as well. And it's just really bad. Give me some hope for Sam. I mean, Sam said it was a pathetic display, so he obviously acknowledges it.
It just, you know, Everton seems to be the club that everyone thought, oh, this could be the next, you know, really good football club, well run over the years, you know, stands for a lot of good stuff. And all of a sudden, it's turned into a car crash, isn't it? And, you know, I felt for a little bit for Ronald Koeman in the summer, because I thought he took the brunt of the blame for a lot of mistakes that happened. And, you know, you often see that in football. And Steve Walsh surely has to be accountable. Is that... It always made me, you know, at Leicester, he was director of football, but chief scout, whatever his role, but it was always next to Claudio Ranieri on the TV on match day. So I wasn't quite sure how many games he was watching. And then we sort of, he's gone to Everton now, and the money that they've spent and the method or the plan or the lack of the plan. And it's just, this is what you get. This is what, you know, you go to Arsenal with a setup and a back three of Michael Keane, who's just been a poor signing. Magnala comes in as well, poor signing. And then you've got Sigurdsson and Rooney, who are probably your two best players.
Magnala's a poor signing. The guy just got there. I mean, it's a bit mean, right?
Oh,
I mean,
watching him at the weekend, you can't argue anything else.
Yeah, but
he
wasn't bad at City. I mean, the second time round, he was all right. Let's talk about a guy who left. And I know you seem to have this, I don't want to say obsession, but perhaps, you care a lot about the fate of young English players. Ademola Lookman. Mm. Now, they sign him for a ton of money. He scored that ridiculous goal last year. I remember, I mean, I watched it and I said, like, whoa. And, you know, especially because he looks like he's about 11 years old, which he's not really. And now they sent him on loan at Leipzig, which I think is probably a good place. And you'll get a good education, good life experience. And he goes and he scores on his debut. Now, Allardyce says that because they have Walcott and Bolasie, who between them cost $50 million, there would have been no room for Lookman, and sending him on loan was the right decision. Do you agree with that?
I mean, he's only started four Premier League games in 12 months under three different managers. And you know, with them bringing in Walcott, And with Bolasie being back, I don't think he was going to get more football unless one of those guys was going to be left out. I would say that Bolasie, since his injury, has not looked like a player who is ready to be what Everton need to be at the moment and what Allardyce wants him to be. And maybe he should be starting ahead of Lookman. I don't have a problem with the Walcott thing because you know they've signed him with a view to playing him, certainly. So I don't have a problem particularly with the idea of players who are not playing going away on loan and having a good opportunity to develop. But it just looked, in the case of Lookman, it looked like, well, he might give you a bit more than Bolasie at the moment, so why are you doing that? And he's a really talented player, but it just seemed that Allardyce wants to go with the experience at the moment. And I think when you look at the midfield and you look at Schneiderlin, who looked so good at Southampton and then so disappointing at United and even more disappointing at Everton. I think it's bizarre. So, you know, the experienced players often seem to be the ones that are letting Everton down. So I would say that the best thing Allardyce could do in some ways is to build around those good young players. He started with Jonjo Kenny the other day, but Lookman and Tom Davis and
while you're at it, Mason Holgate, who's another young player.
To be fair, they've given Calvert-Lewin a good run, haven't they? He's the sort of the only one really at the moment of this new golden generation of English players that is getting genuine game time. Mm. What I would say is, if I was a manager, I'd always have a couple of young players on the bench. I'd always do it. I can understand not starting him, but to bring him on, I just think young players give you something different. You know, they almost have that naiveness of sort of, you know, they don't have the fear. Like you say, the senior players at the moment are the ones letting them down. They're the ones that seem to have this fear in their game where the young players don't possess that.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Love the game?
Then don't miss The Game Daily. It's your lunchtime update from football's finest writers, and it's only at thetimes.co.uk.
We're going to have two mini debates this week. I know we're all excited. One, I'm assuming we'll all broadly agree on. Possibly the other one, too. I want to start with Mourinho compared the crowd at Old Trafford with the crowd at Portsmouth a few years ago, which was very intimidating, and it was a small ground, and they made a lot of noise. Ollie, help me, because you're more of a Mourinhologist than I am when it comes to reading the tea leaves. But I kind of took it as almost like a throwaway comment, like, oh, I'd love it if the fans were louder, but because, you know, we saw what a small, passionate crowd in an enclosed atmosphere can do. But I think on this occasion, Mourinho wasn't trying to send a deeper message. But it seems to me that a lot of the media have interpreted it that way. We have some dude, some United fan, you know, complaining about the atmosphere at Old Trafford in the game today. We have Matthew Syed, saying that, oh, well, clearly the lack of passion at Old Trafford is because of you, Mourinho. What's your take? Is this a throwaway from Mourinho? Or is it one of those things where he's trying to send a message?
I think Mourinho chooses his words so carefully and so precisely that I'm never inclined to see anything as a throwaway comment that he says. I mean, it's and also, it's not the first time he said it, and he even put it in his programme notes earlier in the season where he was saying, oh, I hope our noisy fans turn up today unlike the other night or something to that effect. And so he's clearly got a bee in his bonnet about this, as he had at Chelsea and I think as he had at Real Madrid. And he's got a point in that Old Trafford isn't you know, on a Saturday afternoon game against modest opposition, Old Trafford generally isn't there. But neither's Anfield, neither's the Etihad, neither's the Emirates, neither's Stamford Bridge.
Anfield.
Anfield's great when it's loud. It's the best games and the big games and the action-packed games rather than your typical sort of Saturday 3 o'clock kickoff. The criticisms of atmosphere are reasonable, but whether they should be coming from a manager of a club one of many clubs who seem to sort of go out of their way to dilute atmosphere. People should be listening to the fans on this issue. You know, I think fans are frustrated by numerous factors about ticketing, about pricing, about location of fans, about what you can do when you're sitting in your seat, should you stand, etc. There are so many other issues, and to just simplify it as, oh, the fans didn't make much noise today, I think is a bit insulting when those fans are paying through their nose, and in many cases, and it's not about United and Mourinho, but in many cases, not really being greatly entertained. It's there are so many other different issues to it in terms of what clubs generally pursue in terms of atmosphere. It's hardly surprising that you don't get atmosphere when everybody's on the phone and everybody's being encouraged to log on to the Wi-Fi and tweet their pictures and blah, 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 use your hashtags of the match.
Okay.
All that kind of thing. There's truth in it, but there's so much more to it than that.
Hey, you hit the nail on the head, the game's changing and so on. Scully, are you still a season ticket holder?
I have a joint season ticket.
You are a season ticket holder at Old Trafford. You've been going for many, many years. We've got a piece here from a guy named Andrew Kilduff in the paper, who's the co-founder of the Stretford and Flags Group. Are you familiar with him?
I know the chap, yes.
Okay, you know Andrew, perfect. He says, it is a middle-class game now. Hasn't it been like this for a long time? And maybe Andrew Kilduff shouldn't be complaining. And in fact, it was probably a lot like this during Sir Alex's heyday as well, after the turn of the millennium when United were beating the stuffing out of everybody. And United fans were a lot noisier on the road than they were at home when they were infiltrated by the prawn sandwich people and the guys on the phones and the Norwegians and all this stuff, right? Or am I wrong?
No. You're very correct. The best atmosphere at Old Trafford recently has been under the David Moyes era, when there were, it was going horribly wrong, and I think it sort of stirred a lot of pride and passion. Really, this isn't a Manchester United problem. It's English football's problem, and it's something that is getting worse and worse and worse. And like you say, if you go to the big games, you'll get an atmosphere, but the general, all the top clubs, maybe Palace in the Premier League is an exception, the atmosphere is extremely poor at these games. It is so sanitised now, and supporters, and I can speak from experience, there's so much that you can't do. You can't stand up, you can't do this, you can't do that, and it's a huge, huge problem. I was at the Emirates, I was at Arsenal 2-3 weeks ago when they played Palace at home to 4-1 up, and even the Palace fans sang a song where they joked, if Arsenal sing, we're on the pitch. It was like a library.
That's really not fair at the end. Of all the clubs you mentioned, you pick Arsenal, which notoriously, I think is the lamest.
I've been to them all, and it is.
Okay. So you're not saying Arsenal's worse than everywhere else?
No. It's everywhere.
Fine. Counter-argument, which is sort of the argument Matthew Syed makes. Okay. But part of this has to do with the change in the demographics of the fans. Yeah. Part of this has to do with the fact that, even though the Premier League hates it when I say this, but Premier League supporters are the oldest in Europe.
Yeah.
Partly because it's expensive, and partly because it's a bunch of people who are growing older, and because the kids don't go to games because they're watching on their social media or playing games on Twitch. All these things put together,
means that you've got more people with deeper pockets going to the games, and they probably don't want to agitate, and they don't want to fight, and they don't want to stand, and they don't want Scully to get up and stand in front of you shouting, singing the Martial song. And all of this pays for Mourinho's wages and Martial's wages, and maybe he should just accept it and get on with it, right? Because Ollie, I've been to football in this country in the 1980s, at the end of the 1980s, admittedly, but still, the 1980s. It looked nothing like it does today, but you know what? Everybody was terrible except for Liverpool. I mean, really, really bad, bad players. Am I wrong here?
Well, you might. I mean,
seriously, you can go on YouTube and watch some of this. I mean, I remember somebody telling me about what a phenomenal player Paul Davis was. A very nice man, by the way, right? I don't understand. Paul Davis wouldn't even be playing in your beloved championship today, right? And you're nodding along, which means you agree with me. Not because he's a bad person, but just because the game has changed. Sorry, go ahead, Ollie.
Well, do you want me to answer the thing about atmosphere or to defend the honour of Paul Davis in an era when England had, you know, Brian Robson.
He was always hurt.
You know, Glenn Hoddle. Even someone like Neil Webb, never mind Paul Gascoigne. You know, there were lots of international standard players. It was. I don't think it was as bad as you're suggesting, but obviously
there's a lot of terrible players.
Anyway, the atmosphere issue. Are you suggesting people should just live with it?
Is that the price we're paying for success? Basically, is it the price that you want to hang on to your best stars rather than in the 80s when people like Ian Rush left the country because he could make more money elsewhere, right? Because the club wouldn't pay him. Today, you have the money to hang on to your equivalent of Ian Rush's or Harry Kane or whatever. You have the best foreign stars. You got this incredible product packaged all over the world. You don't have the perception that hooliganism is always around the corner and some National Front guy's going to stomp on your head. You certainly don't have issues of overt racism. All of this has changed for many, many reasons. You don't have stadiums that are fire traps. Is part of the price you're paying for this a loss of atmosphere? And I think that's what Side argues, and that's what I'm throwing to you. I'm not taking a position on this, by the way.
It is a price we're paying, but whether you need to pay this price to that extent, I mean, wouldn't it be an even better product if, in addition to the safer stadium, in addition to the better players, etc., there was also a really good atmosphere? And it seems that, I mean, clubs don't need to squeeze every pound out of every fan for every seat. A lot of the clubs, the bigger clubs in particular, now get less and less revenue, smaller and smaller proportion of revenue from match day, because they make so much commercial, they make so much from TV. They don't need to bleed the fans dry. They need to, in my opinion, they need to invest in atmosphere, see it as a, if this is what it takes for them to take it seriously, then to see it as a commodity, to see it as something that would improve the product.
Ollie,
and improve
the problem you've got is that the executive people that run the game have got no idea really how an atmosphere is created, how it's I've been to Paris Saint-Germain a couple of times this year, and the atmosphere is superb, but it's orchestrated, it's coordinated, it's,
you have ultras there though.
Well, exactly, it's coordinated.
Fan groups here in England. When I think it's different. I think Anfield is different at Anfield, different at Palace. But at most clubs, whenever you see something coordinated, you know there's a reason those banners and those flags look so pristine,
because
it's the club that pays. That's what I mean.
If you go to a lot of the French clubs, you will go to PSG. There are four or five people that are in these crow nests that are high above that have speakers.
Yeah, but those are ultras. That's what I'm saying, is that those are organised fans, which come with a whole raft of other issues.
Every club in the Premier League's got organised fans, Gab.
No, but they don't. They don't have ultras.
They do.
If you bring up the ultras on the continent, you have to take the good with the bad. Now, the ultras can go and march into Nasser Al-Khelaifi's office and say, like, we want buses for this, and we want you to pay for them, and we don't want this steward stewarding our area because we don't like him, and if this guy causes problems, we'll deal with him, not you, and so on. Now, I'm pretty sure, I could be wrong, you know Andrew Kilduff, I'm pretty sure Andrew Kilduff does not have Ed Woodward's number on speed dial, and doesn't show up at Ed Woodward's house and tells Ed Woodward what to do.
That's my point I've just made to Ollie. The executive people running the game have got no idea about an atmosphere and about going to games and the actual match day experience.
This other thing, I don't know that there's much to debate, but I think there are a couple important things to be said. There's a man named Tony Henry who until recently was involved in player recruitment at West Ham. He was let go after making remarks in an email, I believe, talking about how he didn't like signing, quote, African players because they cause problems when they're not in the squad. I don't want to get into the issue of how they got them to say that on the record. It wasn't the cleverest thing. But what really struck me about this is, right, stereotypes are a big part of football. We talk about, you know, Germans being disciplined and Latinos being fiery and whatever else. And part of that is based on nurture and culture. Klopp himself did a piece this weekend talking about how, like, you know, in German youth academies, the kids go to school until they're 16 or 18, and that comes first, and the football comes second, so they're less obsessed with money and blah, 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 right? So that's got a formative thing. So if I were to generalize about a guy coming from German football, there'd be some validity to it because there'd be some sort of general shared experience. What I have a big problem with what this guy says about African players is that it doesn't make any sense. And he, of all people, he's got African players on his team. Pedro Obiang is an African player in the sense that he's of African descent, but he was born and raised and came through the ranks and is a product of Spanish football and is Spanish. Same thing for Angelo Ogbonna, who is Italian and is a product of Italian football. Archer Masuaku is a product of French football. The other dude, there's a Swiss guy, Jmilson Fernandes, is, hey, look, the guy's black. He's of African descent. Yes, but he was born and raised in Switzerland. So he's a product of the Swiss environment. I just thought this was so poor. And I've heard stuff like this before from agents who pitch guys to players and so on. But generally, there's a certain logic to it. Whereas this guy certainly gives the impression that he was doing it all based on skin color. Does this make any sense to you, Wally?
No, it doesn't make any sense at all. And particularly when it's, you know, you look at the West Ham squad, which, you know, you've just gone through it in some detail. And there's people like Ayew who have gone and funny enough, been moved out in this transfer window. But they have signed a lot of African players over the last few years. And for a guy suddenly to be saying, oh, they're the problem, you know, they cause mayhem when they're not playing, I think is alarming, insulting, incredibly crass. It's just ridiculous. But it also just smacks of the kind of flip-flopping that you get at a club. And for him to be saying that African players are the problem, well, look at West Ham. You could look at any number of players from any different number of countries over the last few years and say that they have been a problem. And I don't think, you know, Martin Samuel did a very good piece the other day about it, and we're saying, well, it doesn't seem to be about where you're from, it's where you're at. And I think he's exactly right. I think West Ham is a club that does not have a good culture, and it seems to bring out the worst in a lot of players, and no matter what the nationality. But I don't think for a minute that the number of African players they have has been a problem, never mind the problem. And I think it's alarming, insulting, distressing to hear a guy say that.
Skol, you operate in this space. Would you say that it is fair? Obviously, you judge every case individually, but does it help to make certain assumptions about people based on where they were raised and the type of education, the type of football education that they got? But that's completely independent of race.
I think it's an awful comment that he's come out with, and I think Ollie's just hit the nail on the head there, and I think it has nothing to do with race. I think it's the environment at West Ham that's probably causes that, if there is any problems as well. So I think you have to, you know, go that extra mile to now. Football is, it disappoints me when this happens, because football actually is a very, very multicultural society and probably doesn't ever really get the credit it deserves for the way it's portrayed, really. And with all, you know, we have so many different nationalities come to the game, which is fantastic. I just think clubs, and I know a lot of clubs do, they go out of their way to make people welcome. They go out of their way to make families welcome. And there should just be one criteria when you sign a player, and can he make your squad better?
Time now for some quick hits. Manchester City are held by a stout Burnley side who, I thought anyway, played very well despite some big absences. Ollie, is it all about Sterling's miss or is there more to it than that? And please don't tell me you'd rather talk about the fact that Pep only named six subs and what a stain it is on City and his reputation.
You're right. I think that the reaction to that was a bit strange and a bit excessive. I think other managers have done that this season at times. West Ham did it a few months ago. I don't remember any brouhaha about that. But the Sterling miss at 1-0 up was a really bad miss. And it did feel like at that point that it might come back to haunt them because they seem to have to be running out of legs in that game. And Burnley were doing very well. So I thought a fair result in the end.
Alexis Sanchez propels Manchester United to a 2-0 win over Huddersfield as Mourinho drops both Paul Pogba and your god, Anthony Martial. Scoey, I assume you're hoping this is a temporary thing with these two guys, especially Martial, being left out.
The cream always rises to the top, Gab. The lad Martial will be back, don't worry about that, scoring goals as well. He's having a great season so far. I was at Wembley on Wednesday and Paul Pogba was awful. It's the worst game I've seen him in a United shirt, and he has been good recently, so it's just a little bit Mourinho keeping everyone on their toes. Don't panic.
Swansea get a point at Leicester City and are now unbeaten in a month, including wins over Liverpool and Arsenal. Ollie, were you one of those people who said they were doomed? And what do you make of the turnaround?
I think they did look doomed, but it seems to be similar to last season when you know a manager comes in January and just makes everything that was going on before look like it was remarkably silly and has them looking like a competent top-flight team again. And it is going to be ridiculously tight at the bottom of the table. A manager can come in and improve a team and they might still go down, but Swansea suddenly look good.
It's a great argument to relegate more teams. Riyad Mahrez is left out by Claude Puel in that very game, following rumours that he handed in a transfer request to move to City on deadline day. Scoey, do you actually believe that City were willing to spend that much on him? And can you explain why he's sulking now when there's nothing that can be done? The transfer window is closed. Unless he wants to move to China, where it's still open until February 28th.
No, I just think the whole situation is a mess, really. And Riyad Mahrez isn't coming out with any credit. I think whoever's advising him, he needs to get rid of them. I think Leicester have management of the situation is very, very poor because it's quite obvious that Mahrez is looking to move on to a top team. It's the same every transfer window, so they need to come up with a plan of what to do because it's just the same every 6 months. And also, I think it's not great by Man City unsettling a player on transfer deadline day that they...
Can I jump in here on this? Ollie, I was away. I didn't get a chance to report this. Do we know for a fact that this story is real and accurate?
What, that City bid for him?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, they did. No, nobody's denying that they moved for him.
Why? It doesn't make any sense. Why?
Well,
this is so stupid.
Well, because they have so many players. I agree that they didn't need him. It would have been a luxury signing. But
he's not a pressing player. He's not that good. It's a lot of money. They have financial fair play. I mean, come on, it's Riyad Mahrez we're talking about.
And you know, there is a need there to accommodate some of the younger players, or integrate some of the younger players who, you know, a lot of them are in attacking positions, and you know that would have been yet another obstacle in their way. But their squad is it's not a thin squad, but it's not numbers wise, it's not as big as some, and it is stretched a little bit by injuries, but just looked very short term
right,
to me.
But the reason City's squad is stretched is because there's limits on the number of foreign players over the age of 21 that you can have. That's the only reason. So if they are going to spend 65, 70 million, they're better off spending it either on some English guy or on more kids who you know, fall in that under 21 category. Anyway, Crystal Palace are held by Newcastle United. Ollie, would you like to praise Rafa's genius in the face of adversity or complain about Christian Benteke's finishing?
I wouldn't kick a man when he's down, so I'll talk about the job Benitez is doing. I think if you look at that Newcastle squad, it looks so ordinary quality wise, and they haven't come up with a sort of set bounce that Brighton and Huddersfield have come up or Bournemouth have come up in the past. It's a an ordinary group of players who are sort of in danger of existing under a cloud at Newcastle, and Benitez has got them organised, spirited, and they look ordinary, but I think he's doing a decent job.
Southampton roared with a 3-2 win away to West Bromwich Albion as Jack Stevens steps in to calm a dispute between James Ward-Prowse and Sofian Boufal. But if you haven't seen this, there's a free kick to Southampton. Both people want to take it, and up steps Big Jack and says, right, you're taking it, not you, go away. And he made the right choice because Ward-Prowse then scored on the free kick, and Boufal was the first guy to go over and congratulate him. Scoey, as an ex-pro, did you freak out when players squabble over free kicks?
If I'm honest with you, I can't really remember too many times it happening. The managers I played were very, very organised, and this was all done weeks in advance in training. There was no sort of, are you going to take it or am I going to take it? I just find it very unprofessional.
So your managers were clearly more organised than Mauricio Pellegrino.
Yep. Yeah. And in the last few minutes of injury time, we were all switched on.
There you go. Mickey Adams, thanks you.
Gab, one for you. Fascinating piece on Paris Saint-Germain and the French media.
Yeah, it was very good, wasn't it?
Is it a sign of things to come?
I hope not, in some ways, in the sense that what's going on right now is the venerable French newspaper that keep being attacked left, right, and centre by other journalists. And you know how rare it is for people in the media to really go after each other, being accused of dishonesty and writing false, knowingly false stories surrounding Paris Saint-Germain. But then there's this whole other sort of alternate new media that's come up, a Twitter account called Paris United, which is also a website, which is actually an anonymous account. And they broke some huge stories relating to PSG, which raised all sorts of questions in terms of who's behind it, what's really going on. It's an interesting sort of, you know, microcosm of where we could all be heading, and I think also an obvious parallel with the real world in terms of where people get their news from. That's all we've got time for today. Many thanks to my guests James Scowcroft and Ollie Kay, and another plug for Ollie Kay's piece on Duncan Edwards. I wondered whether you could have seen anything new about Duncan Edwards, but I think Ollie's managed to do that. Now, remember, it's just £3 for a three-month trial. If you want a subscription, you can search The Times online. In addition to what I think is very good content from The Times, you also get content from The Sunday Times. And you access highlights of every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League, as well as the FA Cup. And who doesn't love the magic of the cup? We're going to be back next Monday after the North London Derby at Wembley. And before that, remember, if you're up in the great Northeast, Alison Rudd will be hosting a special live podcast from Newcastle. Ollie will be there, as will Newcastle manager Rafa Benitez. As more importantly, I assume, so will George Culkin, right?
Yep.
There you go. You can hear all this on Friday. It's going to be up. Sadly, I can't be there because I'm going to be in Miami. Ha ha ha. You guys will be in Newcastle. Sorry. Anyway, I'm going to be back next week. And please do look out for our special live podcast, game podcast, on the road from Newcastle.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
If you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.